Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I was born by the river, river, brick, 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 brick. I was born by the river. I was shaking that ass.
Hi, I'm Madison Malone Kircher.
And I'm Rachel Hampton, and you're listening to ICYMI.
In case you missed it,
Slate's podcast about internet culture. On today's show, we are going to be taking you on a wild journey that starts with a pretty innocuous cover of a Nina Simone classic and ends with alleged embezzlement and somehow involves one vice president, Kamala Harris.
Rachel, that's a Mad Libs. Like, that's a fill-in-the-blank paragraph. Like, add a noun, add an adverb. Remember what an adverb is, then add an adverb.
It's amazing because the description gets at perhaps 4% of the story.
Mostly, though, it's a story about how when you find yourself falling into an internet K-hole of drama and mess, like the one Rachel just so eloquently described in brief, the smartest thing you can do, honestly, is to take a beat, take a breath, and do a little bit of your own research. The reality of events usually ends up looking different than, say, the original viral tweet might have indicated.
But first, we simply have to talk about Madison's absolute favorite topic, the Bachelor franchise.
In the outline for today's show, you wrote Batch, B-A-C-H, and for a brief fleeting moment, I thought we were going to talk about Bach, which I thought, okay, I'm ready. I can vibe with that.
I'm sorry to disappoint you. We're not talking about Bach. We are talking about Batch, the most important thing in the world.
Since the late Baroque.
Oh my God. Anyway, the reason we're talking about this is because on Monday, Rachel Lindsay, the first Black Bachelorette, did a huge As Told To interview with Allison P. Davis. And the top line of it is shit's fucked up. The real kind of meat of it is that Rachel really held nothing back. There were no holds barred. Like, it was full of incredible details. And kind of just really outlined how terribly this franchise has treated her.
It sort of starts out in present day-ish. She lays out this story with that interview with Chris Harrison defending Rachel Kirkconnell attending a racist party in antebellum Southern dress.
Yes.
Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm. Good job. I'm so proud of you. I'm actually really proud of you.
So the core of the story, at least my understanding of it as a bachelor, bachelorette, neophyte, is that she's calling out the toxicity of the show's fandom.
Yes. And there's perhaps no one better acquainted with it than Rachel Lindsay. I'm going to give you a brief outline of her time on The Bachelorette, but if you guys want to know more, then you can always listen to our Bachelor episode, wherein which I give a mini master's thesis on my theory of The Bachelor. But as I said before, Rachel Lindsay's the first Black Bachelorette. She was cast on a season of The Bachelor with a white lead. In this piece, she talks about how the producers approached her, how from the beginning they were very aware of her place as one of the first Black contestants with a really accomplished career. She is a lawyer and was working with a really prestigious law firm. And it was kind of just a story that had not been told on The Bachelor yet. She goes into all her hesitations with it and the way that she was kind of treated on next season, which is she kind of always knew that she wasn't ever going to marry him, and the kind of way they framed her disputes with other contestants in this way of like, Black woman is aggressive and cold as this white woman is crying. So this is her
experience. Stop doing that, people. Yep. White people, we got to stop doing that.
Truly. And so she goes into this, and then she's approached to be the Bachelorette, and she has like a full hesitations about it. She's like, I don't think I want to do this. This franchise has just, I don't think it's ready for that. But she like goes home and these people at her church are like, my daughter's really excited to see you because she's never seen someone like her do this. And so she does The Bachelorette and it does not go well. It's impossible to summarize like that season, but like there are racist contestants. Race is made a plot line in a way that is like deeply harmful to Rachel herself. Her final choice that she ends up marrying is framed as kind of like a backup to this white man because they really want to focus on this white man who is like objectively mediocre. Basically, she's not treated well. And then that doesn't even get into the Bachelor fandom of it all, otherwise known as Bachelor Nation. But Rachel, in this piece with Allison P. Davis, makes a distinction between Bachelor Nation and Bachelor Clan. Clan with a K.
I was going to say, in case it's not very obvious.
Yes. She says, Bachelor Clan is a hateful, racist, misogynistic, xenophobic, and homophobic. They are afraid of change. They are afraid to be uncomfortable. They are afraid when they get called out. What she kind of gets at is the way in which the Bachelor franchise, this like 19, 20-year-old franchise, has cultivated this toxic audience. And in wanting to kind of modernize or cravenly capitalize on the groundswell of support for like diverse leads, they want to have their cake and eat it too, which is to not alienate their core toxic audience, but have this lead who their audience is going to attack over and over and over again, even once she leaves the show.
Right, because she got bullied off of Instagram, correct? After her season?
Yeah, so Rachel ends up after the show being really involved in Bachelor Nation. She like does podcasts. She's kind of actually trotted out as like, look at this thing that we did. But she's also consistently criticizing and pushing the franchise to be better.
This brings up sort of an interesting point we talk about when we talk about a lot of online celebrities or celebrities who then go on to have big online presences, is that fans start to feel this weird sense of entitlement to every and all aspects and moments of their lives.
Yes. And they feel very possessive of this.
That's a good way to put it.
That they consume. And in their possessiveness, they don't like change. And they don't like being pushed because things like The Bachelor or reality television in general are kind of framed as this like comfort fluff thing. And so people don't want to think critically about the things that they're consuming because they're not really taking you super seriously anyway. But the showrunners, in always looking to broaden their audience, want to be able to have Black people be the lead or have just like Black people on the show or just like don't want to be called out for being actively racist. But what they don't want to do is have to actually deal with this toxic audience that they've created and that they are putting this Black lead in front of. Like, they are opening this person up to a firing squad and wanting to be clapped for.
Starting off with a real light one today.
Super light. Just, you know, some frivolous reality television and the incredibly terrible audiences that they cultivate that they don't want to alienate, but that they are actively trying to diversify while not acknowledging that you can't diversify racism.
They take it offline, too. I feel like we should note, and Rachel Lindsay points this out in her piece, like she had to hire security, personal security, to quite literally protect her physically.
Yes.
It's not just, I think, to think about hatred online. It often gets watered down in people's minds to, oh, trolls and name calling and just mute them, block them, get over. No, this is very real. It is mentally, emotionally, and physically damaging. And I can't wait to read Rachel Lindsay's book.
Honestly, yeah, please. Like, I will be first in line to pre-order that tell-all because I cannot recommend this piece enough. There's just a lot of details. Like, if you watch The Bachelor, you'll want to know. But even if you don't, there's... I mean, Madison, you were reading this piece and you were like, wow, you pitched this idea. And I was like, another Bachelor idea. And then you read the piece and you were like, okay, this franchise is wild.
Messy, messy, messy.
But that's enough on racism for today. After the break, we'll be back with more racism, a different kind of racism, or at least respectability politics, whatever. Specifically, we'll be talking about the drama that unfolded on Twitter over the weekend after Chloe Bailey of the iconic duo Chloe and Halle did a Juneteenth tribute set to a cover of Nina Simone's Feeling Good that went viral for a few, maybe like 27 different reasons.
We'll explain all 27 of those after the break.
It's a new life for me, yeah, it's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy as is genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Okay, we are back and feeling good.
You just had to, didn't you?
It was right there.
Yeah, it's low-hanging fruit.
My apologies to the estate of Nina Simone. Please don't sue me.
I don't even know where to start with this story, but I guess we can say that it starts on Juneteenth when Chloe Bailey of Chloe and Halle, who, if you don't know, where have you been? But they are the kind of musical wonder kids, proteges of Beyonce. Their album Ungodly Hour, superb in every single way.
Where were you? Truly, where were you?
Anyway, Chloe, one of the sisters of the duo, performed a rendition of Nina Simone's Feeling Good for a Juneteenth special on ABC. And this rendition was interesting, to say the
least. She looks great. She's in like a full-on black bodysuit.
She looks absolutely incredible. And so she's wearing this incredible outfit. She's in a room alone, as most kind of pandemic era performances are for specials now. And she's just throwing it back to feeling good. That's it. That's it. There's no other way to describe
she's
it.
She's quite literally feeling good.
Yes.
It's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life for me. And I'm feeling.
Okay, the literal range.
No,
those
like,
bass notes, those yeah. whistle tone, the literal mm-hmm. range. This is not me appropriating this phrase. I'm literally commenting on the range of notes which she sings in this cover.
You will hear no dispute from me. Chloe has a set of pipes on her. But the thing about this performance and the thing about this song and the cover of it is that I'm so sorry, but it's really giving me like college burlesque troupe, but with a budget. Like, I love her so much, but I cannot lie and say that I saw this video come across my TL and I can't lie and say I didn't start laughing. I fully did. It's just like.
It did prompt me to Google the 50 Shades of Grey soundtrack because I was convinced, absolutely convinced,
that
exactly a sexy cover yeah. of Feeling Good was on in one of those movies. It was not. This in my head.
But it wasn't Last Holiday, the iconic movie with Queen Latifah. But it's just the thought of 50 Shades of Grey in the song. It's just really funny. The combination of it being for a Juneteenth special just reminded me of this absolutely iconic Vine and how this performance was kind of a non-ironic version of it. We're going to play this Vine. I'm going to apologize in advance because you're going to have this stuck in your head for the next 2 weeks.
I was born by the river, river, brick, 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 brick. I was born by the river. I was shaking that ass, bending over, popping pizza. I was making that cab pop.
Rachel's gone. Down for the count.
I listened to that Vine in preparation for this episode, and I still, like, fully could not stop laughing. Because, like, that's what this, that's the exact vibe that this performance gave me. And what it gave a lot of the internet, clearly, because after this performance video drops on Twitter, like, people kind of just, you know, roast her. But, like, not in, a malicious way, but just on, like, a, you just, you know...
It's objectively funny.
You popping booty to Nina Simone. Like, what's going on here?
Just feeling herself in her catsuit alone with, I assume, a smattering of crew members in masks operating cameras.
Yeah, it's just so funny. Like, just imagine showing up to, like, I don't know, like a dedication ceremony for Juneteenth, and you're like, there's Chloe just, you know, absolutely living her best life with this 50 Shades-esque cover.
Chloe and Halle actually used to share an Instagram account, and in relatively recent internet history have now established independent internet brands. And Chloe getting shamed for how she dresses and the photograph she posts. I mean, do we still say slut shaming in 2021? Because that's, I think, a good way to describe, like, what she experiences online.
Exactly. And I want to make a distinction between, like, the kind of original reaction I saw and, like, the that
where
kind
this
of
is
level
going,
of
where you can tell this is going.
Yeah. So the first reaction I saw is, like, fully aware of the way in which, like, Chloe's getting slut-shamed. It's, like, most of the reaction I see is from Black women themselves. And it's just, like, playfully clowning on her in the way you would, like, your cousin. Like, it's, like, no one is slut-shaming her. It's just, like, this is a fucking hilarious thing. This is a non-ironic version of, like, popping pussy to Sam Cooke. But, like... Then the internet gets a hold of it and it stops being fun. Like, it fully stops being fun because then people earnestly are yelling about how Chloe's performance was, like, too sexy and denigrating the good, wholesome name of one Nina Simone.
I have a question. Yeah. What do they think feeling good was about?
I'm just like, have you listened to the words of that song? Like, it's not like, you know, Chloe chose strange fruit or some shit. Like, that would actually be fucked up. Like, no. Like, she picked the song that had a vibe. And also, let's be real here. Nina Simone, like, would have either laughed at this performance in, like, a non-malicious way or, like, fully supported it, because Miss Simone at one point said, my attitude towards sex was that we should be having it all the time. Sex positive is underselling it.
I'm tired reading that all the time.
I'm just like, Miss Simone. But she, like, she famously danced naked in a nightclub in Liberia. And so for this kind of online backlash to be like, how dare you besmirch the legacy of Nina Simone by being sexy. Like, you, ma'am, are besmirching the legacy of Nina Simone by saying that she is
with
not
your
sexy.
Ignorance, yeah.
Yes.
I really wish this was the end of the story, but at this point in the saga, the ghost of Nina Simone weighs in on Twitter.
Not the ghost.
The estate of Nina Simone tweets its thoughts about the Chloe performance in a now deleted kind of shady tweet. It was a gif of Nina Simone. The text said, "Hey, girl, sit down." And the tweet is now nowhere to be found. But of course, you can find it everywhere online.
But I mean, this is the thing. Nina Simone died in 2003. Twitter was launched in 2006. For what reason is there a official Nina Simone Twitter account that's not just tweeting, like, about what Nina Simone's music is currently being used in, but kind of is tweeting in the voice of Nina Simone as if Nina Simone is alive?
Because someone at the estate of Nina Simone can see the future and knew that decades later, Juneteenth would become federalized as a holiday and that a young pop star, R&B star, would make a sexy cover of Feeling Good and they would need to weigh in.
I really wish that person at the Nina Simone estate would use their powers of prescience for something better than this.
Yeah, it is sort of funny to when you read through the tweets on the estate of Nina Simone account, because they're like, you know, the more recent ones are not super voicey. There's a recent tweet about how they very proudly licensed Feeling Good for a Dove commercial. So it was very jarring.
Yeah. A Dove commercial.
So someone at the estate of Nina Simone realizes that this tweet was a bad idea. The tweet gets deleted. And that's the end of the story, right?
Uh-uh. Here's where shit gets messy. Nina Simone's granddaughter, Rihanna Simone Kelly, comes through to defend Chloe. But that's not just it. She also adds approximately 17 layers to the drama. So the first tweet from Kelly goes like, everyone's coming at Chloe Bailey for her performance, but what y'all don't understand is that grandma was a free-spirited woman herself. She would have loved that performance as much as I do. Relax, Chloe killed it.
Goes on to refer to her grandmother as a motherfucking badass woman who did what she wanted to when she wanted to, which, again, this could be the end, but it's not.
It could be, but it's not. Approximately some... So after she defends Chloe, she quote tweets this tweet from a rando that says, Nina Simone passed away April 21st, 2003, and Twitter launched July 15th, 2006. Why would her estate even make an account for her? Like, promoting posthumous projects and whatnot is fine, but actually trying to impersonate and interact is very weird. Simone Kelly then comes in with a quote tweet saying, Nina's granddaughter here. My family doesn't run her estate anymore. It was taken from us and given to white people. Our family name was dragged in the media. We get no royalties, nothing. Want to hold someone accountable? Ask Kamala Harris why she came from my family? Hashtag Nina Simone.
Well, now I'm hooked.
Nina Simone and Kamala Harris in the same sentence?
So this prompted me and you to do some research. This was the point at which I think we both saw the tweets and said, oh, it's time to pull up a magnifying glass.
Time to take out our little inspector hat.
And try and figure out what exactly Rihanna Simone Kelly is talking about and why she has invoked the name of V. POTUS. After Nina Simone died, her daughter, so that's Rihanna Simone Kelly's mother, Lisa Simone Kelly, was put in charge of the estate of Nina Simone. Nina Simone's final wishes were that her wealth be used to fund musical education for children in Africa. If that sounds vague, take it up with Nina Simone.
Fight a ghost if you want.
In 2013, though, Lisa Simone Kelly steps down from this role. In a fairly public legal battle, she's accused of breaching fiduciary duty, allegedly diverting funds, including a reported $1.5 million into her own bank account, per a report from the Daily Beast, who looked at some of the legal filings in the case.
Which, shout out to the Daily Beast for verifying these legal records that were floating around on Twitter, because the internet loves to be a sleuth.
So, where Kamala Harris comes in is she, at this point, is Attorney General of the state of California. So this case is under her. And at one point, according to the Daily Beast, she wants to surcharge Lisa Simone Kelly almost $6 million and then $2.5 million in interest, like a very large sum of money.
Scientifically, I would say a lot of fucking money.
It eventually ends with an agreement between both parties. Kelly no longer is involved with the estate. She loses her rights to her mother's work. And then, probably most importantly, related to what her daughter is now tweeting, Lisa Simone Kelly can no longer say or even imply that she is connected to her mother's work, to her mother's estate.
Exactly. And so this battle happens in 2013. It is reopened when Rihanna, the granddaughter of Nina Simone, opens up about it in detail over the weekend on Twitter. She, in a...
it's a large thread.
A patented move, tweeted, deleted, and then started tweeting again.
TM.
Because she had to check with her family to make sure it was okay. Because again, His legal battle in 2013 specifies that her mother is not allowed to say that she has any affiliation with Nina Simone's legacy or estate. So this Twitter thread comes out. It immediately goes viral.
Yeah, she makes a lot of very serious claims. You know, she talks mm-hmm. about that the estate of Nina Simone is in, quote, shambles, that her family no longer owns any of Nina Simone's work, that her mother almost killed herself from the depression related to the legal battles.
And then she also tweets, you know, while we're just asking.
Oh, I forgot about this part.
She's like, while we're just asking Kamala Harris, like, why she's done all these things to my family.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
That's me. I'm the lawyer for ICYMI.
She also says, let's ask Kamala Harris why a Nina Simone song was sang at the inauguration to swear her in as VP. Which, John Legend did perform at the televised inaugural ball singing Nina Simone's Feeling Good.
I mean, speaking of pandemic musical events where you have one artist alone, I think John Legend was like playing a piano on the Lincoln Memorial on the National Mall.
A new life for me. Ooh. And I'm feeling
I mean, you have to admit that knowing the way that Kamala is involved in this fucking, like, lawsuit, for her to have a Nina Simone song played at her inauguration is a little bit shady.
I kind of love it.
So, at this point, Rihanna Simone Kelly's mother posts a video on Instagram.
I support her 1,000%. I support everything she's saying. She's speaking her truth. She's speaking the truth of our family. She also supported Chloe Bailey's interpretation of Feeling Good, which I second. I think she did an amazing job.
Have you seen the documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone?
Yes, I have. I really like that documentary. But that documentary is not super complimentary to Nina Simone and her relationship with her daughter, if I remember correctly.
Right. I mean, that's one of the, it's a few years old now, but one of the things I remember enjoying about it, or finding enriching about it, is it does paint a fairly comprehensive picture, right? You know, Lisa talked about her mother as being abusive and that Nina Simone abandoned her when she moved to Liberia. She calls her mother a monster. And also, in equal measure, talks about her mother's gifts and talent and the music she shared with the world.
When mom would see you cry, she knew she could push your buttons. That's what she wanted. And I would not give her that satisfaction. When she would hit me, I would look her dead in her face. And she'd like, you better cry. You better cry. I wouldn't do it.
You get this kind of complete picture, which is what I was thinking about when Rihanna Simone Kelly tweets a second thread that offers a different set of allegations about how the legal proceedings in 2013 actually went down, according to her.
She says a lot. And it's plainly kind of refuting the Twitter sleuths who over the weekend have just been like pulling court document after court document and like circulating them on Twitter and saying, actually, Miss Rihanna Simone Kelly, your mother was embezzling. Like, that's why you don't have anything to do with your grandmother's estate. And there's a lot of speculation, actually, that Rihanna Simone Kelly didn't know about this kind of court case drama, and that that's why she did this Twitter thread, and that like maybe no one informed her that her mother was embezzling, which is somewhat paternalistic. And in this second thread, she kind of directly addresses that and says that her mother never embezzled funds, that her being stripped of her title as a state administrator was a calculated legal move on Kamala's part because, and I'm quoting directly from a tweet here, in the revoked will Kamala was using, which is a whole other story unto itself.
Tell the story, please, Rihanna.
My mom was protected in every way from litigation, especially she used attorneys and accountants to help her run the estate, which she did. Mom being forced to resign would strip her of her protection. Simone Kelly also says that since Nina Simone's estate was French, since Nina Simone was a French resident, the U.S. government actually had no right to be involved. I'm not a lawyer. I don't.
We have established we are not lawyers, not mathematicians, not scientists. I think the best way to sum up that second thread is that Rihanna Simone Kelly refutes all of the claims that are running around Twitter and have been reported about this 2013 legal proceeding, and then offers up her own set of allegations about what actually went down.
And that's pretty much where it stands as of right now, is this second thread kind of taking over for the first thread. And I would like us all to recall that this began with Chloe Bailey throwing it back to Feeling Good and ended with
none of us feeling good. All right, that's the show. We'll be back in your feed on Saturday, so please subscribe. It's free, and the best way to make sure you never miss an episode, which, Rachel, cover your ears, I'm going to say it again, is the best way to make sure you stay feeling good. Please leave a rating and a review in Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends about us. Follow us on Twitter at @icymi_pod. It's a great place to DM us your questions, topics you might like on the show. And you can also always email us, icymi@slate.com.
ICYMI is produced by Jasmine Ellis and Daniel Schrader. Our supervising producer is Derek John. Forrest Wickman is Slate's culture editor. Gabe Broth is editorial director of audio. See you online.
Or not.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.